It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, President Trump just returned to the U.S. following a summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. We'll learn about their negotiations and why some are calling the meeting a failure. First, it's Food Friday, and we're talking about how to cook with some of Wisconsin's best cheeses. There are hundreds of award-winning cheeses made here in the state that are great to eat on their own, but they can also be worked into some of our favorite dishes. From appetizers to desserts, cheese can be one of the kitchen's most versatile and effective ingredients. Christine Hansen is a freelance writer covering food, art, and travel. She's the author of The Wisconsin Cheese Cookbook, which comes out today. She joins us now from our Milwaukee studio. Christine, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Christine, in addition to the recipes, which we'll get to, you got to visit a bunch of cheesemakers around the state. Talk about some of your experience doing that.
Absolutely. Well, I'm a city girl here in Milwaukee, but I love, you know, nature and the countryside. So it was a really great opportunity a year ago to travel around the state and meet these farmers and spend time with cows and goats and, of course, eat cheese.
And Wisconsin, I think we could say we have an embarrassment of riches when it comes to good cheese and lots of variety of cheese. Can you talk about just the diversity that we have to work with?
Absolutely. I think a lot of people, especially outside of Wisconsin, equate us with cheddar, which of course we do very well and we love and we consume in great quantities. But really, there's not a cheese that we don't make here that I can think about in terms of all the common ones. There's blue cheese, mascarpone, burrata, mozzarella, you name it, we have it here.
And you also visited some restaurants and talked to restaurant chefs who are coming up with creative ways to use cheese. Is this an ingredient they get excited about?
Absolutely. I mean, we know already that we're in this farm-to-table movement. It's almost, you know, expected that a restaurant would be sourcing locally, and cheese falls right into that category. And there's so many great examples. Here in Milwaukee, we've got Dave Swanson with Braze, who's always been a proponent of sourcing locally. And for him, he's actually getting the cheese from a few blocks away at Clock Shadow Creamery. I mean, you can't really get much closer than that.
Before we get to actually cooking with cheese, obviously one great way to eat cheese is to cut it up and, you know, eat it. You look at some great pairings for cheese and other stuff on a board. Can you talk about some of your favorite pairings of Wisconsin cheeses and other stuff?
Sure. Well, gosh, there's so many. I'm not sure how much time we have to talk today. but I do talk in my book about this philosophy that you see in Europe, especially where you're pairing beverages, whether that's wine, beer, spirits, anything else you drink, with cheese from that region. And the reason is that the terroir, which is the French term for the soil, is shared with those products. So you're going to find some commonalities between those two. So in my book, I talk a little bit about, you know, one example could be, you know, Door County Creamery, which is in Door County, perhaps eating with a Wisconsin wine that comes from that area as well.
Talking to Christine Hansen, her brand new book is The Wisconsin Cheese Cookbook. We've got a few of her recipes she shared with us over at WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's get into one of those recipes now. Here's one, Tallgrass Reserve Grits with Greens. First of all, Tallgrass Reserve with Grits and Greens. Before we hear about the recipe, can you talk about the cheese you're using in this one?
Sure. That cheese is from Landmark Creamery in Paoli, which is a very artisan, very small creamery, although you can find their cheeses in Madison at Fermagination. I know they carry it. And also in Delafield, Restaurant ID, I'm told, has it on their cheese plate. But yeah, so two women named Anna own and operate this creamery. And that recipe is really interesting because I don't think we think about grits a lot in our diet up here, being Northerners, right? We forget how awesome they are. And in that recipe, it's just really, really a great ingredient.
And how does this come together? Grits, this Landmark Creamery cheese, and the greens.
Exactly, yeah. So, you know, it could be a breakfast dish. It could be, I mean, we can have eggs, which is a breakfast dish any time of the day, right? But traditionally, grits are more of a breakfast food. And that's one thing I really thought about with this book is that we already know about mac and cheese and pizza and grilled cheese, which are awesome, don't get me wrong. But I really wanted to showcase the variety of dishes that you can make with cheese, and that includes breakfast.
Oh, let's not knock the mac and cheese. You do have a recipe for it that, you know, takes it up to another level. What kind of cheese are, and a lot of people are doing fancy mac and cheeses around the state. Macs and cheese? I don't know. Which cheese do you put into your recipe?
Well, in the book, I have a couple. I have the Supreme Mac and Cheese from Carr Valley and another, which I'm blanking on right now. The Tuscan Mac and Cheese, which is, you know, kind of different from Tuscany, right? Inspired by that. What do I like to put in my mac and cheese? I really think for me, it has to have cheddar. But that doesn't mean that I won't put another cheese in, because I think it can be really fun to think about dishes that have not just one cheese, but two or three.
And is there kind of a meltability factor that comes into it? Some cheeses work better in a melty product like a mac and cheese or a pizza or wherever you want that to get good and melty and spread out.
Absolutely. I mean, when you think about fondue, for example, I mean, you definitely want it to be melted. You wouldn't want to have a lumpy product. So goat cheese, for example, is not really going to work in that type of dish. Goat cheese, I do see in mac and cheese quite a bit, but it's usually got another cheese in there that has, you know, kind of a better melting quality.
Staying on the pasta and cheese theme, here's another recipe you shared with us. It's up at WPR.org/Food Friday. It features a Yellow Door creamery cheese. The recipe is baked gnocchi with pumpkin and fontina. This looks fantastic. First, talk about the cheese choice, the one you chose from Yellow Door.
Sure. So Yellow Door Creamery is a newer creamery here in Wisconsin, and it's up in the northwest part of the state. Owner of the company, interestingly, is an Italian cheese importer out in New Jersey. So they obviously, you know, heard about Wisconsin milk being amazing and decided to have a plant up in Turtle Lake. The cheesemaker is from the French Alps, so very legit. That particular recipe, it uses a creamery's Tuscan rubbed fontina. And I like that because a lot of times you see the rubbed cheeses on a cheese board, but we don't necessarily think about taking it one step further and using it in a dish, just like you might have cheese and a spice. Well, in this case, they're together.
And this has pumpkin in it as the base of the sauce instead of like a tomato or a cream sauce.
Exactly. So when I think of that recipe, I really think about the harvest, the fall, right? We have a lot of pumpkin products during that time, and this is a great example.
I still have some pumpkin in my freezer, I know, from back in the fall. And I gotta say, one thing I tend not to do with pumpkin is anything that involves cheese. How does pumpkin combine? How does it pair with cheese? Pretty good?
Pretty good. I mean, they're both, pretty earthy products, so I think it's a fabulous pairing. I suppose what you could do as well is have a pumpkin beer with the cheese, because here in Wisconsin, we have a lot of pumpkin beers, right, in the fall. So that might be one way you could kind of play around with that flavor pairing a little bit.
We're talking to Christine Hansen right now. She's the author of the new book, The Wisconsin Cheese Cookbook. And you can join this Food Friday conversation at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite Wisconsin cheese to cook or bake with or just to eat? If so, what do you pair that with? Do you have favorite recipes that use cheese, especially cheese made here in the state? Have you found ways to be creative in cooking with various kinds of cheese in the kitchen? Or if you have a question for our guest of great cheeses to use from around the state and what to use them in, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page and check out a few recipes from Christine at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our Food Friday conversation now with Christine Hansen, author of the Wisconsin Cheese Cookbook. That's available starting today. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite cheese-inclusive recipe that you love to cook again and again? What's your favorite kind of cheese to cook with? especially if it's a Wisconsin cheese. How do you incorporate it into your cooking or baking? Or do you have a question for a guest about how to do that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. Louise is with us in Dodgeville. Louise, hello.
Hi. I wanted to get your guest feedback on if she's ever cooked with Rush Creek Reserve from Upland Creamery. It's a fall release. It's a soft cheese made from raw milk, and it's delightful. I mean, I just eat it, you know, warmed up with a good baguette, but if she's ever done anything with it, cooking-wise.
Louise, thanks for the call. We've got a lot of cheesemakers. Upland Creamery. Have you encountered that, Christine?
Yes, I'm familiar with the creamery, and I profile the creamery in the book. Andy Hatch is the cheesemaker. To be honest, I think that cheese is so good that I haven't cooked with it. I've just eaten it. I've sliced it on a cheese board. But I'd like to say and also clarify, the recipes in the book actually aren't my recipes. They are from the creameries.
Oh, the creameries provided themselves. I didn't catch on to that.
Exactly. And sometimes that message gets lost. I think we get so focused on Wisconsin cheese, like we can't see anything else, right? We're just like blinded. So they actually provided a recipe in the cookbook, which I would encourage you to play around with. It's with fingerling potatoes. And so that might answer your question.
Yeah, and a thing with a lot of these recipes, Christine, is that a lot of them are pretty simple. There's not a zillion ingredients, I guess because the cheese is giving a lot of the flavor to begin with.
Right, absolutely. I mean, I think if we're given a choice when we're making dinner or whatever, you know, easier is probably easier for most people. I mean, sometimes it's fun to spend half a day cooking, but I really wanted to have recipes in here that were quite easy. I even have some that have three ingredients, with cheese, of course, being one.
Thanks for that call, Louise, at 800-642-1234 as we talk about cooking with cheese. Let's get into dessert. Now, there's a recipe, a brownie recipe we'll get into in a bit, but one tip in one of these recipes that I hadn't thought of, you know, apples and cheese, I know, go really well together. I think you had an apple pie with cheese in the crust. Do I have that right?
Yes. Yes, and that recipe is so special. It's from Carr Valley. They provided the recipe. It's actually Sid Cook's mother, who's 101 years old. So it's her recipe. It's an apple pie in a sharp cheddar crust. And that's an example of like two really good pairings, apples and cheddar. They go wonderfully together.
Now let's talk about cooking with cheddar, really common cheese, but there's a lot of options out there from mild to aged, a huge difference in flavor and the amount of flavor. How do we calibrate the right age and intensity of cheddar in different kinds of recipes?
Well, I think it's similar to what you would choose to eat raw, right? You know, what, like for me, my sort of aged cheddar sweet spot is 3 to 4 aged. For me, if it gets a little too, you know, 10, 12, I don't personally care for the crystals in there. The 1 and 2 year age is too mild. So first, people should think about what flavors they like in the product by itself. And then you can kind of take it from there. I mean, the good news is that I don't see a huge difference in the different years that a cheese is aged and how it might perform in the recipe. The difference is going to be in the taste.
Christine Hansen is with us on Food Friday. Her new book is The Wisconsin Cheese Cookbook. Still time for you to join in. If you like to cook with cheese, tell us what your favorite cheese-based recipe is, what kind of cheese you like to cook with. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Okay, Christine, I promised people some brownies here. This is another one of the recipes that you passed along to us. This is, I don't know about this one. You're going to have to sell me, I think. Goat cheese brownies. Help me out here.
Yeah, now that's an example. If I was in your Madison studio today, I would have brought you a pan. I promise.
Let's book you again right now. No, okay. Tell us about this goat cheese brownie.
Okay. So the goat cheese brownies is a recipe that's provided by La Claire Family Creamery up in Malone. That's an example of a farmstead creamery where the animals, in this case the goats, supplying the milk, live on the property. And honestly, I don't think it gets any fresher than that. So these goat cheese brownies, the family provided to me. And the ingredients are, of course, goat cheese, as well as, you know, cocoa powder, semi-sweet chocolate, butter, and more butter, and heavy cream. But yeah, I mean, they're just really delicious. And it's an example of, you know, sometimes we need to think a little broader in terms of ingredients. I've certainly heard a lot of chefs say that goat cheese can be a substitute for other products. I mean, when you think about, I like to bake cheesecakes, and for a while I went through a pretty serious in-depth study of baking cheesecakes. I just love them so much. And I found that there's so many dairy ingredients you can substitute, right? It doesn't always have to be cream cheese. You can use sour cream and mascarpone, which is a recipe I have in the book for cheesecake.
And I think of goat cheese as having like that really distinctive flavor. I like it, but kind of, I don't know, pungent. I don't know the words to describe it. That really works in a sweet dessert.
It really does. I mean, like anything, it's going to be in moderation. In this particular recipe, it's 4 ounces, which I believe is not much bigger than a small log that you would buy. And when you think about all the other ingredients in there, there's chocolate, butter, right? So there's a lot going on, and you almost need that goat cheese, the fat and the acidity to stand up to those other ingredients.
Let's bring on another caller now. Herb is with us in Mequon. Herb, hello.
Oh, good afternoon. Say, you know, what I really crave, and right now thinking about it, is a good old-fashioned Milwaukee-style cheesecake. And it's not made with cream cheese. It's made with baker's cheese, which I can't find in the store now anymore. So is it possible to make baker's cheese at home, or what would a good substitute be for baker's cheese?
Baker's cheese. I'm not familiar with that, Christine.
I am not familiar with that either. I mean, I could take a few minutes and Google and get back to you. But yeah, I'm not familiar with that at all. That's really interesting. And you've given me something to look into and possibly write about. So thank you.
But give
I'm sorry,
Herb,
I don't
oh, that's okay. But give Herb some ideas of what he might do that would be available in stores. In your experiences with Wisconsin cheeses, what have made some good cheesecakes?
Sure. Well, like I said, you know, the traditional recipe has always been cream cheese. In fact, on the Philly cream cheese box, there's a recipe right there, right? But, you know, what you could think about doing is using mascarpone. That's certainly a good ingredient. It has that sweet note to it. Blue cheese cheesecake is something else to think about if you wanted more of a savory. Obviously, you wouldn't want to use too much of the blue cheese because that can be pretty sharp and acidic. And I think, you know, some people love blue cheese. Other people find it a little too heavy. But those are some alternatives I would encourage you to look into. Belgiosio up in Green Bay, they have mascarpone. I believe they produce that. It's hard for me to remember. Some of these cheesemakers literally have hundreds of products each. But that could be a good supplier for you.
Herb, good luck. Hope that helps you out. Hey, let's go to one of the basics, Christine. You can make grilled cheese with a zillion kinds of cheeses, and I guess breads too. What are some of your favorite ways to go with a grilled cheese?
Sure. I really love blue cheese and a grilled cheese sandwich. And one of the dishes I look forward to every August and September when the fresh figs are in season, which if you're a fan like I am, you know that you gotta take them when you see them at the store. They literally sell out. I like to slice some fresh figs and have blue cheese as the ingredient in that grilled cheese sandwich. I also like to use different types of bread. I find that challah bread is really good, as well as Texas toast, those thicker breads, especially if you have a lot of butter on that. They really make all the difference.
We got an email from Grant. Grant says that Bluemont Dairy from Blue Mounds sells a fantastic aged Havarti. He says he likes to use his Uplands Pleasant Ridge cheese with his country sourdough bread with toasted sesame seeds. Yeah, talk a little bit about Havartis, aged Havarti. I mean, I like Havarti in general. Do you have good ideas for cooking, Christine, with Havartis?
That's a great question, because what I found in researching this book is that we have quite a few Havarti producers in Wisconsin, way more than I thought, because I have to admit it's not my favorite cheese, but doesn't mean that I don't like it. I just don't know. I'm not always attracted to it initially. But Havarti is a really good cheese to have in a sandwich. And I know that sounds basic, but as your emailer indicated, it works so well in a sandwich.
Right. Have you looked into cheese and bread pairings, as Grant was mentioning there? Do you have favorite combos of just, I'm going to slice some cheese, I'm going to slice some bread, boom, there's a snack?
I haven't found anything that doesn't work. So I think that's really encouraging. And, you know, no matter where you are in the state right now, there's so many artisan bread producers, and that can be a fun way to see what they're baking and what's going on, and sort of, you know, using that bread in a really raw way, not cooking with it, but just slicing it on your board, having some cheese, creating a cheese plate at home. I've just been really impressed with what I found as well in the bread industry here in Wisconsin.
And Christine, based on your research for the book, is there an entree or appetizer or whatever that's kind of made it into your regular rotation after all this work you've done on the book?
That's a great question. I have not had a chance to try every recipe in this book because I just haven't had the time. But I have to say, you know, I recently made the Supreme Mac and Cheese, which is from Carr Valley, and brought it to my book club. I'm part of a book club that also we try to read books that have a culinary focus that we can draw from. And that was a pretty big hit. Supreme Mac and Cheese, just like it sounds, it's very cheesy and got a lot going on. And that particular recipe also had some dried mustard, which I had not used at home when I would make mac and cheese from scratch. So I thought that was really interesting.
And the book club loved it?
Yeah, they did. They said they did.
All right. Christine, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you.
That's Christine Hansen. Her new book is The Wisconsin Cheese Cookbook that is out now today. She'll be speaking at Fermagination in Madison on Saturday, March 9th at 1 p.m. along with Anna Thomas Bates of Landmark Creamery. Get those recipes, by the way. She shared three of them from different cheesemakers around the state. You can find those all at WPR.org/Food Friday. The summit between President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un ended unexpectedly early this week. The goal of the meeting in Vietnam was to establish a nuclear disarmament plan in North Korea and find a way to ease tensions on the Korean Peninsula. The United States and North Korea disagree over what led to the breakdown in negotiations, and so far, there's no indication of when the two countries will reconvene talks. Our next guest joins us now to talk about the politics at play and what the future could hold for U.S.-North Korean relations. Andrew Kidd is a professor in UW-Madison's Political Science Department, where he focuses on international relations and politics. Andrew, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, some of the latest reports out today, Andrew, before we get to these negotiations, the U.S. military apparently planning to end large-scale military exercises that they do in cooperation with South Korea. Do you have thoughts on that?
Well, that is the quid pro quo for what North Korea has done since Singapore and before, which is to end their testing of both nuclear warheads and missiles. So the one thing that came out of Singapore was this sort of tacit ratification of this idea that we will stop having military exercises with South Korea and they will stop their missile and warhead tests. So that seems to be an indication that that deal is still on the table, still operative.
Now, we had this meeting. President Trump went to Vietnam to meet with North Korean leaders. What was on the table here? What were the hopes of what would come out of this?
Well, the maximum hopes were that North Korea would agree to get rid of its nuclear weapons and dismantle its facilities that enable it to produce nuclear weapons, and that the United States would then take away all of our economic sanctions against North Korea and recognize them diplomatically, have a peace treaty, and basically restore good relations between the United States and North Korea. Those were the maximum hopes. They were always fairly unrealistic for a number of reasons. And more realistic hopes were that there might be progress towards those goals, but not actually reaching them all at once in one go.
We've heard two different stories about why the talks ended abruptly, it seems like, from North Korea and from the United States. What is your read on why they ended?
I think they ended because North Korea is very reluctant to give up its nuclear weapons and would like to get as much as possible for as little as possible because they think that nuclear weapons are key to their survival, key to their ability to deter South Korea, deter the United States. So for them, it's no light matter to get rid of their nuclear weapons. They've spent enormous resources to acquire them in the first place, so they're not going to give them up lightly and for nothing. There's also there's a lack of trust between the United States and North Korea. North Korea thinks that if they give up their nuclear weapons, the United States might help to try to overthrow them at some point in the future. From the American perspective, if we were to get rid of sanctions in exchange for some demolition of some nuclear facilities, it might be that there's other nuclear facilities that we haven't discovered yet. North Koreans have been very cagey about how much they have, don't want to provide any accounting of that. And so we wouldn't really be able to know for sure that we're getting everything they've got in exchange for the sanctions relief and the peace treaty that we might offer. So there's a lot of mistrust on both sides, and for good reason, given historical legacies.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo had this to say about the end of the negotiations.
We are certainly closer today than we were 36 hours ago, and we were closer then than we were a month or two before that. So real progress was made. I think everyone had hoped we could do just a little bit better, but the departure was with an agreement that we would continue to work on what has been an incredibly difficult problem. Both sides are resolved to achieve it, and everyone walked away in that spirit.
Andrew, is it weird to bring together the two heads of state to have the President of the United States go to Vietnam without more of an idea of what they were working toward, without overcoming this really pretty basic stumbling block?
It's extremely unusual for that to happen. Normally, summits between, say, the United States and the Soviet Union during the Cold War or other states are preceded by very lengthy periods of negotiation at the level of Secretary of State and lower level officials working out all the details. And the summits are usually public events where those deals are ratified, and maybe some details will be hashed out. And there are some negotiations like the Camp David negotiations where there's actual negotiation between heads of state, but those are somewhat rare. Part of the problem is that the North Koreans have been extremely unwilling to negotiate with lower-level American officials because they think, with some reason, that they can get more out of Trump than they can out of the sort of working-level people, and even people like the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo. So you've seen this pattern where Kim Jong-un sends President Trump very flowery letters, which Trump characterizes as beautiful and, you know, substantiates his love for Kim Jong-un and vice versa, and basically stonewalls the lower level officials. And so nothing gets done in between the summits, and then the summits happen, and they are very unlikely to actually succeed under those conditions.
Talking to Andrew Kidd, professor in UW-Madison's Political Science Department, looking at the negotiations over this week between the U.S. and North Korea. President Trump was asked about the Otto Warmbier case. The American student stole, allegedly, a propaganda sign, sentenced to years and years of hard labor in North Korea, released in a coma, died soon after returning to the U.S. The president had criticized North Korea for this before, but had said that Kim Jong-un told him that he didn't have knowledge of that case while it was happening, and President Trump believed him, also referred to Kim Jong-un as a potentially great leader. This has gotten reaction from Republicans in the U.S. Senate. What do you make of what President Trump has had to say about Kim Jong-un?
Well, it got a lot of a pretty sharp response from his family as well, the Wormir family. I mean, this is another instance in a pattern in which Trump basically says that he takes dictators at their words when it comes to a lot of issues, human rights issues, et cetera. He took Putin's word in many cases over those of his own intelligence community. He took the leader of Saudi Arabia's word about the killing of Khashoggi over the findings of his own intelligence community. And now he's taking Kim Jong-un's word that he didn't know anything about Otto Warmbier when it seems hard to believe that that's the case, given that his case had become quite prominent long before he eventually died and was handed over and then subsequently died. So it is another point of criticism for people who think that Trump is either being strangely gullible when it comes to these foreign leaders or is for some reason pretending to be so.
Now, President Trump's predecessors had refused to have direct one-on-one meetings with Kim Jong-un. Apparently, Kim Jong-un and I think his predecessor, that it's been a policy goal of theirs just to be standing on the same stage as the U.S. president, to present themselves as equal players, in effect. Does just the existence of these meetings between a U.S. president and the head of North Korea, is that a propaganda victory for North Korea itself?
Sure, it's a big win. I mean, Kim Jong-un, his father, Kim Jong-il, would have loved to meet with American presidents. There's no question about that. An American president said no for reasons that have to do with the human rights record of North Korea, the fact that they oppress their people, they're one of the most closed regimes on the planet, and that they are still in a state of war with South Korea and have routinely engaged in provocations, shelling South Korean islands, sinking South Korean ships. So there's been plenty of good reasons not to meet with the North Korean leadership, and to reserve that as something that would take place at the end of a process of reconciliation and concessions. And it was seen as a reward for their acquisition of nuclear weapons. It just increases their stature in the world. And to have Trump going over to Asia to meet with them repeatedly when they have done very little in terms of, certainly nothing in terms of getting rid of their nuclear weapons program, just halting the testing of it, seems like an enormous concession.
Andrew, in our last minute, what are you watching for next now that this latest round of negotiations wrapped up early?
Well, it's going to be interesting to see. I mean, the thing that people are worried about is that if Trump becomes convinced that Kim Jong-un is not actually going to denuclearize, despite this wonderful relationship he thinks that he has cultivated with him, then he might go back into a more belligerent posture and start criticizing the North Korean regime again. The sort of tacit arrangement by which they have suspended their tests and we've suspended our exercises might break down. They could start testing again, and we could be back to where we were in 2016, where a lot of people were fearful that there might be some chance of war on the Korean Peninsula. And it might be exacerbated by the fact that Trump feels betrayed in some sense by Kim Jong-un. I'm personally, at this point, not as worried about that, because my sense is that Trump, for Trump, a lot of it has to do with appearances rather than reality, and so I don't think he actually would initiate war against North Korea. But we could certainly see a return to 2016-style polemics and name-calling and that sort of thing.
Andrew, thanks for joining us today.
All right, thank you.
That's Andrew Kidd, professor in UW-Madison's Political Science Department, where he focuses on international relations and politics. He joined us today to talk about President Trump's meeting with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Both leaders ultimately walked away from negotiations without a new deal struck on North Korean nuclear disarmament. Over the last decade, there's been a growing buzz over buying local, especially when it comes to food. Many communities in rural Wisconsin have added farmers markets, and consumers have been paying more attention to where their food comes from. But our next guests say there's still a lot more to learn and do when it comes to creating a sustainable food system. And in order to spread the word, a group of Wisconsin food leaders are putting on the third annual Food and Farms Film Festival. That festival takes place next Tuesday, March 5th at the High Noon Saloon in Madison. Carrie Sudlack is the executive director of the Fair Share CSA Coalition. That's the organization putting on the festival. Carrie, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
And Scott, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here, Rob. Thanks.
Carrie, you're part of the organization putting on this film festival to inspire and create some awareness for viewers. What is the goal of this film festival focused on sustainability?
The goal is to inform and inspire and bring the community together. So this is the Food and Farms Film Festival, and the mission of Fair Share CSA Coalition is to bring farmers and eaters together and to talk with the community about what it makes or how to make a strong local food system, and to talk about why it's beneficial to support local organic small family farms and producers. And so we figured that the film festival would be a great way to do this, especially in a time when there's not a lot happening on the farms. We thought that it would be a nice way to bring eaters and growers together. So we have a lot of farmers attend the event in addition to just the general public. And always have a farm speaker as part of the film festival. And so the goal is to show a number of films bring up a couple of different issues in sustainable agriculture, do a deep dive into those issues through the film, and then follow that up with local leader food system speakers to provide local context to that issue, and then provide a call to action for how people in the audience can take the next step.
And Carrie, this year's theme, I understand, is downstream. Can you talk about that theme and how it carries out?
Yeah, absolutely. So we mean downstream in a couple of senses. One, the most literal sense, focusing on the downstream impacts of what happens on a farm. Scott, I think we'll talk about that a little bit later on in the interview. Reference to the film that he'll be speaking to. And then we also mean downstream in a broader sense. We hope that folks that attend the film festival can really think about and learn about the impacts that their everyday food choices have on the environment, have on the economy, and our community.
Scott, you'll be talking after the screening of the film Big River that features two filmmakers tracing the chemicals they use on their cornfield back to its source, all by canoe. Talk about some of the water issues this film brings up that you think it's important for us to be aware of in Wisconsin.
Sure, absolutely. Carrie hit on two of the big themes that I think the film festival is going to touch on in the sense of food and community. The other two that I'm going to highlight are water and climate. And I'm going to talk a little bit less about climate, but it's irresponsible not to mention the challenges that climate change is already providing for farms and water management when you're talking about topics like food and farming and water. So Big River really traces the impacts of our growing practices and growing choices from a cornfield in Iowa, which could very well be in Minnesota or Illinois or Wisconsin or anywhere in the upper Midwest, all the way down to the mouth of the Mississippi River and into the Gulf of Mexico. And it, I think, really drives home what the impacts are of the choices that we're making with the growing practices we use. And it talks about some of those impacts locally, and it talks about them all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico and the impacts that our choices up here are having on the fishing industry. WPR covered earlier this week the results from a study in Kewaunee County that talked about the nitrate and coliform pollution that is contaminating wells up there and where it's coming from. And what we saw is that a lot of that pollution is originating from agricultural fields and agricultural practices. And the film at the film festival next week will really start to tie that together. And what I hope to focus on during my talk afterwards is that we all need to start working together to find solutions.
And Scott, as someone who works on water issues in Wisconsin and as a farmer yourself, how do you take these water issues and try to deal with them as a farmer yourself?
So as a farmer, and I'm sitting in my house looking out at my fields right now, everything we do on our fields is focused not just on growing quality food, but what happens to the water that falls on those fields and even underground afterwards. So we use conservation practices like riparian buffers, which help protect streams from runoff, and grass waterways, we use cover crops, which is a concept that I think people are becoming more familiar with, where we grow crops in our fields, not because we're going to harvest them, but because they help protect the soil and they help keep the soil healthy and they help keep nutrients where we want them, which is in our fields, not in our streams and rivers or in our groundwater. And I really have the pleasure of getting to work on and practice a lot of these practices day in and day out on our farm. And then in my role at Clean Wisconsin and to some extent on the Fair Share Board, look at the way that we can talk to consumers about those growing practices and their impacts, and look at the way that we can influence state-level policies and what they can do to support farms that are trying to do the right thing and reduce water impacts of their growing practices.
We're talking about the Food and Farms Film Festival coming up next Tuesday in Madison. Carrie Sedlak is with us, Executive Director of the Fair Share CSA Coalition, the organization putting on the film festival. Scott Lasser is with us, a farmer and water program director for Clean Wisconsin. Carrie, as you look around Wisconsin, do you think we have a lot of exciting stuff going on when it comes to sustainability and agriculture?
Yes, absolutely. There's a good number of young farmers entering the field, no pun intended, but kind of perfect. There's a lot of young farmers that are very inspired and very politically engaged and wanting to make a change both in terms of what they're doing on the farm. I mean, I think Scott is a perfect example of this. They're really following what's happening on the political landscape. They're making sure that policies are starting to support more sustainable agriculture practices. Yes, I see a lot of young energy, and they're learning a lot also from what the leaders in the organic and sustainable agriculture movement have learned along the way. So I see like a really fantastic transfer of knowledge. This torch is being passed. So it's very exciting.
Now, Scott, we've talked a lot so far about farmers and what they can do with sustainability. That's only some of the people out there listening. All of us eat food, though. Do you have thoughts for consumers when it comes to looking at ideas of sustainability?
Absolutely. And that's really, I think, one of the things that we want people to take away from the film festival next week and the discussions around these topics. We do all eat. We also all drink water. And so we all need to be invested in this challenge and opportunity. And so, as Carrie alluded to earlier in the interview, our food choices make a big difference. And we've already seen changes in the food industry because consumers are demanding something different from their food. And we spent a long time in the country just pursuing this incessant drive for cheap food. And we kind of forgot about or didn't recognize that there's a lot more to our food than what appears on our plate. And the CSA movement and the interest in CSA is part of the recognition that food, there's more to food than just what's on the plate. And the discussions that I think we're seeing around the state right now pertaining to water and public health and agricultural practices are signaling that consumers are coming back to a point where they recognize that they need to look at not just what's on their plate, but where it's coming from, how it's grown, who's growing it, and that ultimately they can make some choices in what they buy and where they get it from that can have a positive impact on the food system, on the water they drink, on the water that other people drink, and as the film Big River will show, as far away as the Gulf of Mexico.
We'll leave it there. Scott, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Rob.
And Carrie, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you, Rob.
We've been talking to Carrie Sedlak, Executive Director of the Fair Share CSA Coalition. We also heard from Scott Lasser, a farmer and water program director for the group Clean Wisconsin. The event we've been talking about, the Food and Farms Film Festival, is taking place. That's next Tuesday, March 5th at 7 p.m. at the High Noon Saloon in Madison. There's a link with more info on the event at WPR.org. And on the topic of food today, if you missed our Food Friday conversation about cooking with Wisconsin cheese, you could still get a few recipes. There's some cheese-related brownies in the mix and a couple savory recipes as well. You can find all three recipes right now over at WPR.org/Food Friday. Winter rolls on. It's frustrating for some people, but a lot of Wisconsinites get out and enjoy the weather. Ice skating or hockey are great ways to do that. But maybe if you're a skater, you've been out on a lake or a pond and felt cramped, like you could use some more room. Maybe a pond the size of Lake Superior. The UP Supply Company has been thinking about that idea. They took it one step further. If you wanted, they asked this, if you wanted to clear Lake Superior for skating or hockey, but you only had one Zamboni, how long would it take to resurface the whole thing? Well, they did some math. If Lake Superior was completely frozen over, which doesn't happen most winters, we'll roll with it though, you have an ice surface of over 20.2 million acres. An ice rink is about 0.39 acres. So Lake Superior adds up to over 52 million ice rinks. I have not double-checked their math personally. They figure a Zamboni can resurface one ice rink in about 7 minutes. So to do all of Lake Superior, it would take over 364 million minutes. That's about 693 years of nonstop Zamboni. So that's not an option, but there is a plan B. They also asked how many Zambonis it would take to resurface Lake Superior during a 20-minute intermission of a hockey game. You would need to round up over 18 million Zambonis, and of course, people who know how to drive them. Find out more at upsupply.co. This is Central Time.